The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Gene Bajelon is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Missouri State University, a writer for publications such as Open Democracy and Jacobin, and a frequent guest on The Michael Brooks Show. He is also a returning guest to this podcast, this time stopping by to educate me about the Kurdish struggle in Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. It's Sunday night, October 20th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week's podcast is available in full, but our patrons usually get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. They also get access to our History of Communism video series, interviews with authors for our monthly book club, and pretty soon a reprise series called Pop the Left. If you're a fan of this podcast, consider becoming a patron. The music you are listening to right now is entitled Cakewalk, but in just a moment you'll be listening to Gene Bajelon and I discuss the struggle of the Kurds in the era of Trump. Gene Rhys Bajelon is professor of history at Missouri State University, a writer for publications such as Open Democracy and Jacobin, and a frequent guest on The Michael Brooks Show. Today, I'm glad to be able to talk to him about Turkey, Syria, and the Kurds. Gene, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's just start by introducing you to the listeners. You're a Brit living in Missouri, but due to your father, you've been writing about Kurdish politics for quite a while.
That's correct. So my father's Kurdish, my mother's from Wales. I was brought up in the United Kingdom. I did most of my studying in Britain and Turkey. And then I got a job here in Missouri. So I live now in Springfield, Missouri, the Queen City of the Ozarks, in the middle of Trump country, which is a very interesting place to be at the moment.
Yeah, which was a more difficult place to live, Turkey or Missouri?
That's a good question. Well, Turkey was fun. You know, I was a lot younger in those days. We had good time. I was living in Istanbul. So, you know, Istanbul is a pretty cosmopolitan city. You meet a lot of different people there, people from around the world, people from different parts of Turkey. Springfield, less so. It's a little bit more parochial. I moved actually to Springfield after living in Sulaymaniyah in Iraq. I was working in the American university that they opened up there a few years back. And I have to say, of course, Iraq can be dangerous if you go to the wrong places. But, you know, within a few days of moving to Missouri, there was a murder in my university. So it was a sideways step in some respects, but I do really like it here in Missouri. It's actually, you know, a lot of people have a bad impression of the Midwest or a negative impression, but there's some really, you know, it's nice people around here. It's an interesting place to live, a lot of history, a lot of sort of interesting things going on. So, you know, I quite like it out here, actually.
Well, I'm glad that you're enjoying Missouri, and I'm sorry to hear that there was a murder. Let's jump into what's going on in the news, and maybe you can help me out. Because when I try to look into Erdogan's actions against the Kurds and the invasion and bombing of Syria, what I find is that it's all framed around Trump in the news here, which makes it difficult to get to the meat of the issue. I mean, obviously Trump and his decision to withdraw U.S. troops is fundamental and very important to understand as precipitating the event. But it still seemed like the background is not necessarily made clear.
Erdogan has been wanting to go into Syria for quite a while now. He's been disturbed by the political advances of the Syrian Kurds, or more specifically, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are a Kurdish-dominated political organization that received backing from the United States of America in the fight against ISIS over the last couple of years. And he's actually, in 2018, he already launched an invasion of Syria. There was a Kurdish-held part of Syria, I should note. There was an invasion of the district of Afrin, which was under the control of Kurdish forces. And that particular territory was cut off from the main body of the Kurdish region in Syria, the Kurdish-held territories in Syria. So sort of Erdogan went in there and took it over in 2018. It had originally been under Russian protection or under a Russian no-fly zone, but there was an agreement between the Russians and the Turks, and the Turks basically went in there using, you know, their regular army, the air force, as well as Arab militias and Islamist militias that basically are made up of different groups, some former elements of the Free Syrian Army, some ex-Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra people, and according to some reports, even ex-ISIS people as well. They've been formed into this sort of pro-Turkish militia group, and they kind of form the tip of the spear of the assault in Afrin. And now what we're seeing is a similar kind of military action, but on a larger scale, attacking the Kurds east of the Euphrates River.
Is the best way to understand what's happening to think of it in terms of Erdogan's assault on Kurdish people and to try to put down movements for independence and democratic movements, both in Turkey and in Syria?
I would very much frame it in that way. I mean, if you look at sort of the pro-Turkish framing that you see, you know, from some think tank people in America, or from the Turkish government, or from pro-Turkish media such as TRT World, the framing is very much in terms of Turkey's security. So the SDF, and there's a lot of acronyms here, but the SDF came out of the PYD, which was a, you know, Kurdish political party, which was connected to the PKK, which is the main insurgency group that's been fighting Turkey since 1984. Now, there is significant overlap between those two groups in terms of their ideology, in terms of their personnel. During the 1980s and 1990s, the Syrian government tended to encourage Syrian Kurds, you know, instead of causing trouble in Syria, to go fight for the PKK as a sort of a way to try and destabilize Turkey. Turkey and Syria have had a long problematic history of relations with one another. There's a territory on the Mediterranean coast, which was originally part of Syria under the French mandate, but in the Second World War was handed over to Turkey to placate them, to keep them on side, keep them neutral during the conflict. So Syria, there's no love lost between Turkey and Syria. They've had problematic relationships. And the PKK found sanctuary in Syria during the 80s and 90s, although Turkey eventually sort of threatened Syria in the late 1990s and said, look, if you don't get rid of the PKK and the PKK leader, Abdullah Öcalan, from your country, you know, we're going to invade. So we have this sort of these very important connections that take place. However, that being said, the PYD and now SDF are institutionally, you know, distinct from the PKK. A lot of the former PKK people who are in the organization now, including the leader, Mazlum Kobani, they are Syrian Kurds. So, you know, that Syrian Kurds returning back to their region. So there are connections, but the SDF has attempted to sort of placate Turkey, and while maintaining sympathy for the PKK, is institutionally sort of a different political organization. And I would note, and this is a very important thing to note, before 2015, the Syrian Kurdish groups, you know, they you know, their leaders, Salih Muslim, for example, traveled to Istanbul. There was talks between the two sides and so on and so forth. And also with the PKK. So there's been what we've seen specifically since 2015 is Turkey taking a more and more hostile stance to the Kurdish groups in Syria. And I would make the argument that is primarily there's two main factors for that. The first factor is related to domestic politics in Turkey. In 2015, there was a very important election, and two groups did particularly well. Two groups, two political parties did well, as a result, denied the AKP, the Erdogan's political party, a strong majority in the parliament. And those two parties were the Kurdish, pro-Kurdish HDP party, which, you know, it comes out of the Kurdish milieu, but it's sort of moved more to becoming a kind of anti-establishment left-wing party, incorporating labor rights, decentralization, LGBT rights, women's rights on its platform. It's one of the most progressive political parties in the Middle East, and it works within the constitutional framework of Turkey. So that political party, due to the electoral system in Turkey, your party has to get over 10% of the national vote in order to be represented in the parliament. And previously, Kurdish parties to circumnavigate this had run as independents, which meant that they could get some representation, but less than their total of the vote. This in 2015, they ran as a list. Over 10%, which meant that they got, I think, around 80 MPs in the parliament. And so that was on the left wing of politics. But at the same time, we saw the AKP, especially in Anatolia, hemorrhaging votes to the MHP, which is a far right fascist party, or sort of Turkish equivalent of a fascist party, connected to the Grey Wolves terrorist organizations, you know, extreme nationalism, and so on and so forth. So prior to 2015, the AKP had sort of adopted one of perhaps the most liberal attitude towards the Kurdish question in the history of the Turkish Republic. However, they always kept that peace process at arm's length, in the sense that, you know, they would negotiate with Kurdish political actors, but they never really sort of made a bold move amongst the public with this issue. And, you know, when these Erdogan suffered this electoral defeat, he sort of moved away from trying to court Kurdish voters to consolidating his support amongst nationalists, which of course meant clamping down hard on Kurds within Turkey. Since 2015, we've seen Kurdish political leaders, elected Kurdish political leaders, arrested. The co-leaders of the HDP were imprisoned. Selahattin Demirtas and Figen Yüksekdağ were, you know, these were the co-leaders of the party, were imprisoned. Elected officials in local government have been removed. Most recently, after the local elections, you know, Kurdish local officials were replaced by trustees, which are appointed officials. So we've seen this sort of, and of course, this has been accompanied by a growing scale of violence, you know, protests, which have been followed by crackdowns inside Turkey. So, of course, the success of the Kurds in Syria is not necessarily seen then as a positive for the Turkish government. So, as the Kurds in Syria have become more successful, as the sort of F has gained sort of a stronger foothold in Syria, this has been disturbing to Erdogan. And I would argue that's primarily because of domestic political concerns, because the actual security threat emanating from Syria itself is non-existent.
So what is the relationship between the Kurdish forces in Syria and Assad?
This is a very interesting story. So, you know, as I mentioned a moment ago, the PKK was founded in the late 1970s. And it was a hardcore sort of Marxist-Leninist party, very centralized, very authoritarian, and over the years developed a pretty grotesque cult of personality around the leader, Abdullah Öcalan, who was captured in 1999 after being forced out of Syria. And he was basically caught by, thanks to intelligence from Mossad and the CIA, while he was holed up in a Greek embassy. Now, this organization was founded and originally sort of started attacking other Kurdish political parties, which it saw as being sort of more moderate. and not demanding full Kurdish independence, and attacking what it saw as collaborators with the Turkish state. So during, from the 1930s onwards, the Turkish state maintained control through the Kurdish populated regions of Turkey by supporting feudal landlords. So, these, big absentee landlords who controlled vast swaths of land and sort of lorded it over these sharecropping masses. And so they started attacking other Kurdish political parties and landlords. Now, in 1980, there was a coup in Turkey, and the PKK was forced to flee across the border into Syria, where they received support from the Syrian government. They eventually moved into Lebanon. They had a base in the Bekaa Valley. Some of the PKK's first military operations, for example, were against the Israelis, which is a sort of interesting part of the PKK's history. And from 1984 onwards, it started launching guerrilla attacks into Turkey. It established bases eventually, particularly after in the early 1990s, following the Iraq, the first Gulf War, in very mountainous regions in northern Iraq, but also, basically having sort of small cells located across the mountainous region, Kurdish inhabited regions of Turkey. So it basically launched this guerrilla warfare, with its command being based in Lebanon until the late 1990s, until it was forced out. And as I mentioned a moment ago, for the Assad regime, for Assad's father, the PKK sort of was a weapon against Turkey, which was, Assad was in the Soviet camp. Turkey, as we know, is in the NATO camp, and they have this long history of territorial claims on each other. There's no love lost again between the two sides. And so this was a kind of sticking it to Turkey thing, and also a way to kind of distract the Syrian Kurdish population and direct their energies towards Turkey. And, the PKK called for, had a very maximalist sort of political objective up until the early 1990s, which was a united, independent Kurdistan, including the Kurdish regions of Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and initially Syria. But obviously the Syrian government didn't really, want the PKK to be claiming Syrian territory. So the PKK basically accepted the Syrian government line that Kurds in Syria were not really an indigenous group. They were mostly made up of refugees who had fled Turkey in the 1920s, which is not true, but, as part of getting support from Syria, that was the agreement. And, although Öcalan was forced out in the late 1990s, the PKK and its Syrian branches sort of remained in place in northern Syria, recruiting people and so on and so forth, which meant when the Syrian civil war broke out, they were the only Kurdish political party with an infrastructure in place. And the Assad regime basically left the Kurdish regions to them at the beginning of the civil war, withdrawing troops to fight elsewhere in the country. So there's been there has been conflict between the PKK and the Assad regime, but they have a very sort of, let's say, tense relationship, a very complex relationship with one another.
When you look at the civil war in Syria, there's just a whole lot of strange allies or strange bedfellows.
It gets very, very confusing. For example, the PKK has, had conflicts with the Iraqi Kurds during the 1990s, which meant the PKK at one point was getting support from Saddam Hussein, whereas the Iraqi Kurdish political parties, the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of, well, the Kurdistan Democratic Party was allied with Turkey. And then the Kurdistan Democratic Party's main rival in Iraqi Kurdistan, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, would ally with the PKK and Iran against the Iraqi Kurds. So it gets very complicated when we get down into the weeds of things, because we have intra-Kurdish rivalries coming into play. We also have great power politics coming into play. And we have, shifting alliances and different groups trying to take advantage of the Kurdish struggle. It's important not to think, of course, of the Kurds as just being proxies of outside powers. They make, you know, they have their own interests and agendas to support in these conflicts as well. But yes, it gets super complicated.
They're not proxies, but they're not. It sounds like, from what you said so far, that the Kurdish groups are not united necessarily either.
There are different factions in different regions. The best way to think of Kurdish politics is to think of it the Kurdish population, as I intimated, is, you know, spread out amongst various different nation states. There's the Kurds in Turkey, the Kurds in Syria, the Kurds in Iraq, and the Kurds in Iran. And, you know, one of the byproducts of this partition is that in each of those nation states, in each of those sort of Kurdistans, you know, Kurds refer, you know, they don't refer them to them as Iraqi Kurdistan or Turkish Kurdistan. They'll say Northern Kurdistan, Southern Kurdistan, Western Kurdistan. The word Rojava, which you probably heard in associations with the Syrian Kurds, means West. So Western Kurdistan and Rosh Halat, which means Eastern Kurdistan. These names, though, refer to the Kurdish groups in each of the different nation states. And in each of those different nation states, there are different political conditions. There are different, states have different strengths. They're aligned in different ways. And as a result, each of the Kurdish movements in those countries have taken on sort of a different characteristic. So the Iraqi Kurds, who were for a long in the 60s and 70s, were fighting against a sort of generally Soviet-aligned regime, tended to be more pro-Western, gained support from the Iranians and gained the Shah, and then later the Islamic Republic, but gained support from the Shah and then gained support from Israel at some points as well. And then the Iranian Kurds, for example, received support from Saddam Hussein at some point to fight against the Iranians. And, you know, but within each of those different parts of Kurdistan, the movements are more or less united. So in Iraqi Kurdistan, in some ways, they're very divided. You have several major parties. The dominant party is the Kurdistan Democratic Party. But then you have the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which basically has a control over the city of Sulaymaniyah, which is about a third of Iraqi Kurdistan. When we look at Turkey, however, we see, you know, in the Kurdish political groups are pretty united. There's a scholar called Mehmet Gursus who's actually done research on how, you know, often we get this trope trotted out that the reason the Kurds are, you know, don't have a nation state is because they're so divided. But statistically speaking, you know, in political sense, they're not, you know, more disunited than any other group. And in some cases, they're even more united. So, you know, you obviously have ideological divides between the different Kurdish groups. You have more conservative groups. You have even Kurdish Islamist groups. You have and then you have left-wing and radical groups. And sort of the left-wing groups have become dominant in Turkey and Syria, whereas more conservative groups have become dominant in Iraqi Kurdistan. And it's a bit of a mix in Iran. Although because there's heavy repression in Iran, the Kurdish movement is still very much underground.
It sounds like the reason why the Kurds aren't united is because they don't have a state. Put it differently, you know, the British people aren't united either. If your standard is whether or not they have the same ideological position or only one party, but is there a broad desire still for a Kurdish state today?
One would have to draw the distinction between the, you know, official objectives of political parties, realpolitik, and what people might want in their hearts. You know, there's a whole load of people who obviously want Kurdish independence. In 2017, for example, in Iraqi Kurdistan, there was a referendum, and I think, you know, the majority of people expressed their desire for an independent Kurdish state in that referendum. And I would guess, you know, in other places you'd have, at the very least, a significant portion of the Kurdish population wanting an independent state. Now, where it gets a bit more complicated is, of course, would that independent Kurdish state be a unified state? Would you know, the Turkish Kurds get their own state, or the Iraqi Kurds get their own state, and Syrian Kurds get their own state? That's a more complicated issue because, of course, in each of these nation states, the Kurdish movement has developed along a very different trajectory, has very different, you know, even sort of to a certain degree, different myths and symbols. So, you know, a lot like Arab nationalism, we talk about Arab nationalism, pan-Arabism, but, you know, the nation state in the Arab world has proved remarkably powerful, and nation state identities have proved remarkably powerful. You know, attempts at Arab unity have generally fallen apart. The most serious in the sort of was, you know, Nasser's attempt to unify with Egypt and with Syria, and that ended in disaster. So I think many Kurds, especially intellectuals, sort of would like Kurdish independence, and many would say they would like to live in a united Kurdistan. But, you know, on the popular level, the devil would be in the detail. Now, in political terms, the PKK and the SDF in Syria, they have rejected the nation state model in its entirety in favor of what they call democratic confederalism, which is this Abdullah Öcalan's interpretation of Murray Bookchin, who is an anarchist philosopher, I think, from New York, who ended up, I think, going to Vermont or somewhere like that. So Öcalan has sort of interpreted Bookchin's philosophy for the Kurdish context. I believe they had a sort of a correspondence towards the end of Bookchin's life. And out of this has come the model of democratic confederalism, which moves away from the sort of hard Stalinist origins of the PKK towards, you know, a political movement that emphasizes decentralized government and which emphasizes women's rights, ecology, and so on and so forth. And in Syria, they've had the opportunity to put some of these ideas into practice. Now, of course, there are major contradictions. The PKK and the SDF, they still have, you know, they're fighting a war. They have a centralized political, command, a history of centralization and authoritarianism. But at the same time, there have been, you know, real attempts to create grassroots democracy, elected councils, bringing, you know, women's empowerment to the fore. And, you know, people complain, oh, you know, you can over-romanticize the Rojava experience. But, you know, for a group that is stuck in, you know, some sparsely populated, you know, mostly desert regions, it's pretty much as good as you're going to get, if you ask me, you know, like in terms of, and in a region where, you know, we are often told the only two political alternatives are Islamism or secular military dictatorship. So it's a, you know, it's been a very interesting political experiment. It has its detractors, but, you know, compared to the other sides in the Syrian civil war, there have obviously been abuses by the SDF. Although some of the most egregious claims against them, such as that they were ethnically cleansing Arabs, have been disproven. There was a report by, I think it was Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, which was later debunked by a UN commission. And you know, this report has always always brought up by opponents of Rojava. But there's nothing comparable to the crimes of sort of the Islamists in the civil war or the Assad regime itself. So it's been a relatively stable haven in Syria. And I think that's something really important to note about all this.
Is the idea to create this sort of federated, decentralized structure for all of the Kurds and then maybe even spread that to other populations in the region?
Yeah, I mean, spokesman for the SDF have said that they see their model as a model for dealing with the sort of apparent endemic ethnic and religious conflict within the Middle East as a way of resolving it. You know, since the 19th century, the predominant model of state building and modernization in the Middle East has been centralization, creating a strong, powerful central government. Initially this was seen as creating a strong central bureaucracy. Then it was, you know, strengthening the military apparatus and control, and then strengthening the national unity through, forcing one flag, one language, and one nation policies on people. And that model has proved to be disastrous in the Middle East. It's failed in Turkey. It's failed in a very dramatic way in places like Syria and Iraq as well. So it's an attempt to provide an alternative model to the centralized nation state, which has been the sort of paradigm of modernization and development in the Middle East for at least a century and a half.
How bad has it been in Syria for the Kurds since Trump withdrew U.S. forces?
Basically, what we had, the U.S. forces were stationed along the border, very few of them, but their presence deterred Turkey, a fellow NATO ally, from entering into that region. Since their withdrawal, Turkey has launched this military offensive, again, using Syrian militias, Islamist militias, as the spearhead. And they've just come in and committed all kinds of human rights abuses. You know, just in a couple of days, they're like shooting prisoners on the side of the road. They've been going along the main motorway across the north of Syria, chopping people's heads off. The Turkish military has bombed convoys of journalists. There was the sort of cold-blooded execution of the leader of the Syrian Future Party, which is a political party that operates in Rojava, but has been, officially it's called the Autonomous Administration of Northeastern Syria. But, an individual has been critical of the SDF, was just, you know, captured on the road by Islamists and executed. And this was reported in the Turkish state press as being a successful anti-terror operation. They have this sort of very sinister euphemism that they use in Turkish, which is neutralized or, you know, put into a position where then, you know, eksisizbi haline getirildi. They use this like euphemism for executions and murdering people. You know, it's actually difficult to tell sometimes whether they've captured them or killed them. It's like this. So all kinds of, brutalities have been visited, primarily from these Islamist groups who Turkey is using at the vanguard of this operation. Groups that, you know, regard the Kurds and the groups that work with them as being apostates from Islam, as being pigs, as being, you know, who are, you know, hoping that in this conflict they're going to be able to steal property and move in. You know, this isn't theoretical as well, because we saw this happen in 2018 when the Turks invaded Afrin. And the ultimate objective, and this was very clearly put by Recep Tayyip Erdogan in front of the UN, was to ethnically cleanse the region. He doesn't put it in that way, but says that he's going to move 2 to 3 million Syrian refugees into this safe corridor he wishes to establish into regions inhabited by Kurds. So what happens to the indigenous population or the native population? Well, you can guess. They're either going to have to move out or they're going to be killed. And, you know, this was done in full view of the whole world. So it's not like this isn't a conspiracy theory. This was openly said. And the irony is, you know, in the same speech where Erdogan said he's going to kick out, you know, all these Syrian refugees from his country and dump them in a safe corridor in the north of Syria, obviously at the expense of the Kurds, he's crying crocodile tears over Israeli settlement in Palestine. It's really, you know, unbelievable. He literally waved a map of Israeli settlements in Palestine, and then waved his own map of Syria of where he plans to put these millions of Syrian refugees who, you know, come from all different parts of Syria and have been in Turkey for a while and are becoming a political headache for Erdogan. You know, Turkey is a deeply racist society. It has this sort of, much like America, it has a kind of imperial attitude. And it's a society that was built on ethnic cleansing and genocide. Armenian genocide, the purging of the Christians from Anatolia. And, you know, this is in the past, but it's something that the country has never come to terms with. So there's been, you know, there have been very brave individuals. I should mention, for example, Tana Akçam, who's a scholar who's worked on the Armenian genocide. But, you know, it's a very nationalistic country with this kind of deep pathology, and there is, you know, unfortunately widespread support for these kinds of policies, and the Syrian refugees were increasingly being used by the opposition forces. The opposition forces in Turkey, who are often praised in the Western media, for example, there was an election in Istanbul. The mayor of Istanbul came from an opposition party. One of the first things he did on winning this election against the government's favored candidate was to complain about Arabic signs in Istanbul and how he doesn't feel like it's, Istanbul anymore, which is ironic when one considers that Turks across Europe are more than free to put their signs in the Turkish language, but up around the place. But, Syria. In Istanbul, it's somehow seen as beyond the pale, even amongst these opposition figures who are usually painted in the Western press as being liberal opposition to Erdogan.
Trying to keep this all straight in my head, I guess my next question is, has Erdogan been supporting ISIS before now? I mean, you were talking about how maybe members of ISIS were part of the effort to invade Syria recently, and there's been reports of ISIS prisoners being escaping due to the invasion. But has Turkey been supporting ISIS?
This is a very controversial topic amongst sort of experts and scholars on the topic. At one end of the spectrum, the Turkish government claims it's a victim of ISIS. ISIS have conducted terrorist attacks inside Turkey, although I would note that those were often conducted against Kurdish targets or leftist targets. And then on the other extreme, it's Erdogan is just the puppet master behind ISIS in reality. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. Turkey sort of tolerated ISIS. Turkey allowed the flow of foreign fighters to go into Syria. Perhaps they didn't know they were all going to join ISIS, but they tolerated them. Turkey did not really move against ISIS when, it started taking territory in Syria and Iraq. A TV station which showed Turkish border guards sort of fraternizing with ISIS members actually got that TV station shut down. There's been, accusations over Turkish intelligence working with ISIS. And ISIS were, operating, or at least ISIS curious groups were operating in Turkey. And Turkey's not has a very strong intelligence service. We're operating openly in places like Istanbul and so on and so forth. So we have, it's a complicated relationship, we should say. But certainly it seems that, especially in 2015, 2016, Erdogan was hoping that ISIS might deal with his, Kurdish issues, and then he might be able to roll in and, get rid of ISIS and be the hero of the day. It's Turkey has this very complicated relationship with ISIS. I don't think it's, perhaps as some Kurdish groups might say, it's the Erdogan's pawns. I don't think it's quite that one-to-one, but definitely Turkey has tolerated ISIS's presence and has facilitated ISIS in the past.
Turkey is a member of NATO.
1952. It was an early adopter of NATO.
There should be some way to put pressure on Erdogan to constrain him. I mean, the European forces should be able to do something to squelch this invasion. What are Kurdish leftists calling for right now? What should people in Europe and in the United States and in UK be pressing for right now? And to what extent is Erdogan concerned about European reaction?
Last week, a number of Kurdish groups were calling for a no-fly zone so that the SDF wouldn't have to suffer from Turkish air attacks, which is one of the main advantages that Turkey has. But more broadly, left-wing groups have been calling for a boycott of Turkey, have been calling for countries to stop arms sales to Turkey. Some countries have already, in Scandinavia, have already, ended those arms sales. Germany ended arms sales. So, there's a call for a boycott. And, people have taken direct action against you know, high-profile Turkish businesses such as Turkish Airlines. So, you know, I would say probably the best thing people can do in the West, if they, you know, if they want to make their, you know, it depends on the country. You know, if a country has a lot of trade with it, to boycott Turkish goods or to boycott, you know, to call on their governments not to supply Turkey with weapons, not to support this operation. In America, you know, there is, for you know, there's an opportunity to have the American government put sanctions on Turkey. Again, people, you know, Kurdish groups are calling on people to call their representatives, because there's, you know, there's disgust at this operation on both sides of the aisle, although I would note that the Republicans have entirely enabled this by having Donald Trump in power. And I just read before I came on with you that Liz Cheney is trying to blame impeachment for this operation, because Erdogan wouldn't have done it had the Democrats not tried to impeach the president. So, you know, basically pressuring people to...
What's the logic there? I don't understand that argument at all. That just because he wanted to get this in before Trump was thrown out, or?
I think the logic is that everybody was so distracted with impeachment that Erdogan pulled a fast one on everybody, which simply isn't the case. It's, you know, Erdogan called up Trump on the telephone. We do not know what was said on the telephone. You know, we have no idea. But whatever happened was, you know, Trump greenlit this operation, or at least gave the, I think the metaphor someone used was a flashing amber light for this operation, withdrew the troops and then pulled them out. It was, and it was a surprise for the American bureaucracy, you know, because you have the State Department team, which has been making all kinds of promises to the Syrian Kurds and has actually been obstructing them making an agreement with Damascus, saying one thing. They were caught off balance. Ambassador Jeffries, who was, you know, who's made promises. I mean, I was in Iraq a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, an official there told me, you know, the Americans have basically said, look, we're not going to get married, but just think of us as long-term live-in boyfriends and girlfriends. We'll be there with you. And that obviously didn't happen. The U.S. military was caught flat-footed. You know, I've been contacted by a number of ex-military people who are like, you know, who are going on about how ashamed they are. You know, I think it's an offense to their, you know, sense of martial pride that, you know, they were fighting alongside these guys against ISIS for months, and then, boom, suddenly they're pulled out, and this operation is given the green light. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on, but I think, you know, there's in many ways the horse is out of the stable and sort of halfway across the field, because now yesterday, I think it was, there was an announcement, there was an agreement with the Syrian government, and the Syrian troops are moving into those regions now. There's an agreement between the SDF and the Assad regime, and it looks like, you know, for now, the Kurds will keep some autonomy, but the military forces will be rolled into the Assad military, and there's perhaps either Turkey's going to withdraw from this, or there'll be a ceasefire, and we'll see what happens. But it's total chaos on the ground at the moment, because nobody knows what's going on, because this is such a disorderly, you know, way to end this engagement. You know, people on the anti-imperialist left will be like, well, any withdrawal of U.S. power is a good thing. But, you know, even figures like Bernie Sanders were making the point that, you know, the way of leaving in this way, opening the door for a genocidal campaign by a fellow NATO ally is hardly the way to do this.
No, there are times where the U.S. can be a progressive force in the world. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but I think, you know, supporting the Kurds' struggle for independence was progressive. It was always suspicious. It was always seeming very self-interested.
No, that's quite true. I mean, of course it was self-interested. You know, no imperialist power does anything for free, does it? You know, but you have, you know, you have some groups in the United States, you know, glorifying the Assad regime as fighting, you know, and Assad faced like U.S. attacks. The U.S. up and, you know, in the early days of the Civil War were backing all kinds of groups, which ended up degenerating into radical Islamist groups. And, you know, this was partly because Assad chose to strike at the more liberal, secular and progressive opposition early and leave only the nut jobs. Because the Americans pursued a totally incompetent policy, and of course Russia became involved. So, you know, Syria ended up as an inter-imperialist war, you know, with proxies, with, you know, you have Iran and Russia on one side, and you have the, you know, Gulf states and the United States and Turkey on the other side. And there's a lot of people, you know, I don't like the term proxy war in some ways, because of course, you know, these groups on the ground are fighting for their own, you know, for their own reasons. And the Kurds were pretty much, you know, they had a kind of tactical understanding with Assad, like, you don't attack us and we don't attack you. And when ISIS started attacking them, it was the United States that came into the fight. You know, it wasn't the United States who orchestrated that fight, if you see what I mean. The Kurds were already fighting at Kobani, and the Americans came in with air support at the last minute. Now, you can complain. You know, there's a lot of people going, oh, well, you know, you made a deal with imperialists. What do you expect? Well, the Kurds didn't have a very strong hand. And by allying with the Americans, this gave them some limited leverage when the other side has Russia backing it as well. And in the political space that they gained during this period, they acquitted themselves quite well. And I think, you know, you had international brigades coming over. So, you know, there's like an ultra leftism, which just, you know, which actually ends up just romanticizing the Assad regime as being some kind of like milk and honey land. But, you know, this is just not the. And is criticizing the Syrian Kurds for, you know, they had a bad hand and they played it as well as they could. You know, it's very different. You know, they were under no illusions that I don't think that the United States would stay there forever. But, you know, I don't think people could have predicted that, you know, you would have such a precipitous pullout in such a disorganized fashion. That the United States was going to pull out was, you know, Trump wanted to pull out. We saw that in December with the previous announcement and the drawdown from 2,000 to 1,000 troops. But, you know, just doing a phone call with Erdogan, moving troops from the border and opening the way for an operation and sort of this bloodbath, this is really on Trump. And this universal condemnation for whatever reasons, you know, I'm sure there'll be some people out there who think this is a positive thing because it's a humiliation for the United States. But it's hardly liberating the region from outside influence because, you know, Russia is now, its prestige has reached an apex in the region because it seemed to have played the long game and America has been humiliated. So, you know, there's no, you know. There's no balance left between those two. Well, there's balance, but, you know, America's...
What do you think Trump wanted to have happen when he withdrew these troops? What was he expecting? I mean, was he betrayed by Erdogan, or was he just stupid? Or what? I mean, what do you think was going on there?
I mean, the more and more you see Trump, the more and more you realize that he's just not a particularly bright guy, you know, and... probably doesn't think of things, think things through. You know, we've all dealt with people who are just completely unreasonable and who, you know, make no sense. But, you know, in this case, it's a guy who's completely unreasonable, doesn't make sense, and, you know, seems to have brain worms or late stage syphilis, whatever it is. And it's an emperor has no clothes. You know, we can like try and rationalize Trump's decisions, but they're just very impulsive. Or if they're not so impulsive, they're made for very base economic reasons. I mean, God knows what, you know, Erdogan offered him. Did he offer him dirt on Biden? Maybe. Did he offer him, you know, a new deal for a hotel? Who knows?
But he definitely knew that Erdogan was planning to launch this invasion when U.S. forces would.
I mean, the guy doesn't even know. Like, he tweeted the other day that the Kurds were about to fight in Syria a couple of years ago over Kirkuk, which is actually a reference to a conflict between the Iraqi central government and the Iraqi Kurds, and was nothing to do with Syria at the time. So, you know, trying to find a reason for it. I don't think he saw the implications of this, because, you know, he's beginning to try and sort of, you know, as often we see with Trump, he's trying to find a scapegoat and blame someone else. I mean, he's now tweeting that, oh, the Kurds are releasing ISIS prisoners to try and keep us involved. You know, it's really ridiculous stuff. It's just someone who can't take responsibility for messing up. And you have a Republican Party that, you know, defends him no matter what. And so you have this really perverse dynamic where, you know, people are thinking that there's some kind of strategy. I mean, this is a gift for this is a sort of political and military gift for the Russians, in the sense that, you know, there's a wedge now between two NATO allies, Turkey and the United States, and Russia and Assad are now advancing across Syria and have basically seem to have won the Syrian civil war. Now, I don't think, you know, I'm sure on liberal Twitter, there's going to be all kinds of conspiracy theories that, you know, Assad was behind this whole thing. I don't think that's the case. It's just a stupid guy got outplayed. When you have an uneducated and uninterested person like Trump in charge, what do people expect is going to happen? You have all these Republicans crying about this being a huge blow to American prestige, because I think they might have wanted to critique Trump on other things, but I think this is they see this as perhaps a safer area to critique Trump. But they've enabled it all. So this is just incompetence. A lot of, you know, in my experience, and I've come across American officials and high ranking people in my career. In my experience, they're not particularly, you know, impressive. You know, when we look at the American bureaucracy, the military people are actually usually a bit more impressive, because at least they have to have a basic level of competence not to get killed. But the State Department people, the people, you know, these people are very, you know, they're the kind of people who would be always asking a question or in a university seminar or at a debate, or who are good at networking, but aren't necessarily the best and brightest minds on the thing. And they're hampered by the fact often they have like very limited regional understanding. Of course, there are competent people out there, but, you know, you have the blind leading the super blind.
Yeah, and it sounds like in this case, to negotiate the Kurdish situation and the situation in Turkey and Syria and the whole mess well would take immense concentration and effort, which is just something that Trump doesn't have at all. I mean,
and I would add to this, America doesn't have a Kurdish policy. There's no such thing as a Kurdish policy in the United States, because the United States operates on a nation state level. So its Kurdish policy is always the function of whichever nation state that it's dealing with. So, you know, the Iraqi Kurds were the number one allies to the United States. They joined them in 2003. They fought alongside them. American military love them. When ISIS attacked, American military personnel got up and joined them. You know, the Americans basically let them get humiliated in 2017 following their independence referendum. They got booted out of Kirkuk by Iranian-backed militias under the control of the Iraqi government. Now, you know, the Kurds in Iraq, you know, they played a dangerous game and they lost the game. It's not that they had no agency, and perhaps calling the referendum wasn't a wise thing, considering, you know, the Iraqi central government wanting to keep the country together. But, you know, the Americans didn't do anything to protect them. And they got screwed, and they had to go back to the negotiating table and make up with Baghdad and make up with Iran. And in Syria, you know, we have a similar dynamic where, you know, it's the Syrian Kurdish policy is subject to the interests of Turkey, and Turkey's continued insistent that the Syrian Kurds constitute a military and a threat to them as well. So again, there's no Kurdish policy. There's no specialized staff who deal with the Kurdish question. It's just navigating in a real mess.
I feel like I am beginning to be a little bit more educated about what's going on in Syria. It's going to be a continued effort for me to learn more. I hope that you were discussing the possibility of writing a book for Zero on the topic. I hope that you do.
Well, I hope I do too. That's the plan, and I look forward to tackling that early next year, and I hope we have some sort of good news to report by then.